Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and did you guys notice the serious work that is happening in the MAGA Michigan House, led by House Speaker and man baby Matt Hall? Did you see all the hard work that these Republicans are doing for you? Yeah, that's right. They got a little wango tango action here, baby. Wow. Sorry. I know I'm dating myself a little bit there, and my voice didn't like that either. But hey, Matt Hall's the one who invited the one and only Ted Nugent to Lansing here this week. That's right. The Nuge was there. Was it to play a song? I mean, Ted's only got a few popular ones that came out by the time I was born, which is a long time ago, although he was with the damn Yankees. They had a couple of hits, I suppose. However, I was a little disappointed he didn't play one of his classics called Jailbait, in which he sings about having sex or raping little girls. And I applaud Progressive Democratic State Representative Lori Pahutsky of Livonia for sharing some of the lyrics from that song on Twitter, in which the Nuge sang, "Well, I don't care if you're just 13, you look too good to be true." Yes, these same MAGA types always talk about grooming, but yet they're always the ones invested and obsessed with the genitals of children. So I guess Ted Nugent maybe then is a perfect representation of MAGA Republicanism. But apparently, the Nuge was invited by some MAGA Republicans in Michigan to air out some long-held grievances that he's held for the state's Department of Natural Resources. And I can tell you, from my experience, that there are some in the extreme right-wing circles within the hunting community that they always have this kind of resentment towards the DNR. Not the entire hunting community, mind you, but some. And Ted declared that some of the DNR's regulations are driving hunters out of the state. Really? I have never really seen much evidence on that. But he says it's all because of state regulations banning deer and elk baiting due to chronic wasting disease, which the CDC says could harm animals and humans. But the Nuge, like everyone in MAGA, knows more than the scientist, of course, and he wants to reverse that ban. Whatever. I don't care. Maybe he ate a diseased deer, and, you know, that would make some sense. It would explain him a lot. You know, I've talked a lot about finding ways to reverse Michigan's declining population, but I am glad that Ted Nugent fled Michigan for Waco, Texas. We are a better state for it. And for all of the tough talk by Terrible Ted through all these years, I still find it strange that he did all he could to ensure he didn't have to go fight in the Vietnam War. I mean, if he didn't want to go because he didn't believe that he should have died over in that country, well, hey, I get that completely. Unfortunately, I don't think I've ever read stories or found film of the Nuge marching in protest against the war either, meaning Nugent didn't mind giving up his spot for some other person while he got to live the rock and roll lifestyle while having no position or moral standing on one of the most important issues of his young life. But he did hook up with young girls, and well, you can understand why he and dear leader Trump have such an affinity for one another, and why MAGA Republicans in Michigan do as well. And if I have one career regret, one, I got to interview Ted Nugent when I was about 25, 26 years old at my first radio job at WION in Ionia. And I think this was back around 2002, somewhere around that time period. I did not know when I interviewed Nugent about the steps that he took to get out of the draft. You can look it up for yourself. But he went through some extreme steps to ensure that he didn't go to Vietnam. And I wish I would have known that information and confronted him on that information. Because as usual, his machoism is all staged, just like many MAGA Republicanism is, just saying. This is Michigan's premier progressive podcast, and you can follow me on Blue Sky Twitter, Facebook, and the Gram. Visit leftoflansing.com and also subscribe to the show wherever you are getting this podcast. And as always, please give it a good 5-star review and let others know of this podcast as we try to spread the progressive message throughout the state of Michigan. Coming up here in a few moments, Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council, Michigan, will join me to add some further details on a story that I covered here last month. If you recall, the Trump regime's Department of Energy Secretary, Chris Wright, who made lots of cash in natural gas, blocked the closure of a coal-fired power plant in Ottawa County that was scheduled to shut down at the end of last month. The regime is using this bogus energy emergency to keep the highly polluted plant open, even though it's going to cost Michiganders double in terms of energy costs and health care costs. It is an economic issue. I'd like to ask Darrell Slaughter to paint a clear picture over how this action by the regime is hurting the state economically and environmentally, and what steps are being done to fight back and what we can do to fight back. Because this is a blatant attempt to placate the fossil fuel industry, which is littered, and I mean littered, throughout this entire regime. But some are fighting back, including the NRDC and Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel. My talk with Darrell Slaughter is coming up here in just a moment. So, Malachi Barrett from Bridge Detroit this week wrote a disturbing story, and this was happening earlier in the week when we were dealing with some real extreme heat throughout the state of Michigan, and, well, virtually throughout the country. I mean, my air conditioners had an impossible time keeping the place moderately cool throughout the week, but at least I had some AC. Some in Detroit did not. Residents at the Jefferson apartment complex experienced their AC shutting down, the Jefferson apartment complex in Detroit. One resident had to stay at a hotel, and perhaps because of Detroit City Council president and candidate for mayor, Mary Sheffield, for putting some light on this, the management there offered some rent credits for those bearing through all of that heat. But here's a troubling statistic that Mr. Barrett wrote in Bridge Detroit, and I'd like to read it here for you. It says, a 2021 study estimated 47% of Detroit residential structures had either no access to air conditioning or window units. Another 2020 study focused on Detroit found the odds of heat-related illness increases for people with no AC. Hey, everyone, that should not be happening in today's times with so much effort to put into energy efficiency. And as the state continues to give more and more to the billionaires in Detroit and their projects, maybe we should devote a little bit more resources to ensure that those living in the city have some basic needs like, you know, air conditioning. I don't think that's too much to ask. We ought to have a state, or at least some kind of criteria in the state, to ensure that houses and apartments have some sort of air conditioning. That can't be that hard, right? Then we had some more troubling news that Michigan's unemployment rate remains high, ranking 49th out of 50 states for the third straight month. Now, the rate did drop a tenth of a percentage point from 5.5 to 5.4%. But I look at trends and I'm seeing two things here. One, the state's economy has not gotten any better with Dear Leader Trump and MAGA Republicans in complete control of the federal government. Far, far from it. And the economy is cratering while Republicans continue to rush through a bill known as the MAGA murder budget, which is a huge boondoggle and a handout to the rich and elite corporate donor base while leaving the working class hung out to dry. In fact, Pew Research shows the MAGA murder budget is 20 points underwater with nearly half opposing and only 29% supporting. That's why you're not seeing a whole lot of talk about it right now. And I always wonder, is that why we're talking about bombing Iran all of a sudden? And let's not forget the damage that Dear Leader's tariffs are having on the state, not to mention how many Canadians are refusing to travel to Michigan anymore. That's hurting our economy. And nearly half of the respondents in that Pew poll said that they will not benefit one bit from the MAGA murder budget. You think? Even a Fox poll has, a Fox News poll, has the MAGA murder budget 21 points underwater. Now, if I were some governor who has presidential aspirations, and that governor's from Michigan, I may want to get out in front of all of this and paint the Trump regime's failing economic policies and the MAGA murder budget as examples of their failed and radical leadership, because they're going to turn this all around on you, governor. I'd paint them as for the rich and the elite donor base and against the working class, because while Whitmer has indeed done some things that I agree with economically for sure, corporate welfare, the millions, the hundreds of millions that we have wasted in corporate welfare, that is not one of them. And for all the money that we shelled out to corporations here these past few years, the people are still struggling. That's why it made zero sense to sign a bill cutting the state's minimum wage in half. I'll never understand that at all. So if Whitmer's going to run for president in the near future, having a strong working class, progressive populist message, I think would help. The working class is feeling left behind. The entire working class is feeling left behind. They're feeling disillusioned. They feel like the process, they feel like the government isn't working for them. And thanks to neoliberal economic failures, Democrats keep losing elections while the MAGA Republican movement gains strength. And that's what we're dealing with here, everyone, a MAGA movement. It is a movement, not just a political party. It is a movement. We need a movement of our own, which is what we're seeing sprouting across the country with all of those volunteer-driven hands-off and No Kings rallies. The people feel like the Democratic Party leadership isn't feeling their pain and are binding together to form a resistance of their own that many Democrats fail to understand. That's not saying there aren't some strong Democrats out there. Of course there are. I'm talking strictly about the Democratic Party leadership and the Democratic Party as a whole. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Joan C. Williams about her book, Outclassed, How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. She described some ways for progressives to win back the working class vote, which sadly has been going more and more Republican. Democrats and their neoliberal failures have caused many younger working class voters to turn to MAGA fascism. But then this week, a political earthquake occurred in New York City where a 33-year-old Democratic socialist soundly, and I mean soundly, defeated an old-time establishment corporate Democrat and former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary for mayor there. Zoran Mamdani is a New York City council member, and he defied the odds by not only defeating the disgraced Andrew Cuomo, but by winning in comfortable fashion, in runaway fashion. Very few polls had Mamdani winning by that kind of margin or winning at all. Sadly, but expectedly, Cuomo did receive praise and backing from so many corporate Democrats throughout the campaign, including former President Bill Clinton, which perhaps solidified for many last-minute voters why they should not back Andrew Cuomo. And how did Mamdani win? Easy. He spoke to voters. He spoke to some who voted for Trump in the last election because Trump spoke about the rigged economy. Now, dear leader and the MAGA Republican Congress are showing everyone again how their talk about being the working class party was always a farce as they work on passing the MAGA murder budget, which will cancel Medicaid coverage for millions, cut funding for future clean energy jobs, close rural hospitals across Michigan and the country, all so that they can give millions in handouts to Elon Musk and Betsy DeVos. Mamdani seems to be following, to a point, the playbook that Joan C. Williams explained in her book Outclassed by tying progressive populism to economic issues, issues where the working class are suffering and have been suffering for quite some time. Black Americans, brown Americans, white Americans, and millions of us have been left behind, and the economy is indeed rigged against millions of us. But for those who've got millions or were born into it, like dear leader Trump, it works out for them quite nicely. Mamdani centered his entire campaign on affordability and talked about rent stabilization or rent freezes, universal health care, affordable public transit, something desperately needed in Michigan's bigger cities. He not only diagnosed the problem, but he provided bold economic solutions. The old way hasn't been working. They are new ideas. And he is trying to move the Overton window. Progressive populism types of solutions are popular. We have to move that Overton window. And Democrats have to do it. And somebody like Mamdani can do just that. And as Marissa Kabas wrote in her Substack called The Handbasket, Mamdani also didn't back away from other progressive stances. Like, he continued to stand up for the LGBTQ plus community. He didn't throw immigrants under the bus, unlike some Michigan Democrats in Congress this year. And he's been highly, highly critical of the right-wing Israeli government's genocide of the Palestinian people, which a majority, or at least a plurality of Democratic voters, agree with. And you know what he also did? He calls the Trump regime a fascist regime because that's what it is. You've got to label it as it is. Democratic voters want fighters. Well, damn it, he's doing it. And Mamdani appeared authentic to many voters, especially new voters or voters who feel like the system doesn't work for them at all. I mean, here we are. I mean, I've been talking about this. I've seen everybody talking about this since the election, about how Democrats can once again court the youth vote. Well, Mamdani did it, and he scored huge percentage points with young black voters. He focused on economic populism, and the people backed him. Now, on my last call this week, I'm going to talk about how weird some Democrats, some Democratic operatives, some Democratic Party officials and influencers are sounding right now after Mamdani's victory, because they sound eerily MAGA at times. Now, Mamdani quoted FDR in his primary victory speech, and I just want to play it for you because it illustrates exactly what we need to be pressing here as progressives throughout Michigan and across the country.
As FDR said, democracy has disappeared in several other great nations. Not because the people disliked democracy, but because they had grown tired of unemployment and insecurity, of seeing their children hungry while they sat helpless in the face of government confusion and weakness. In desperation, they chose to sacrifice liberty in the hope of getting something to eat.
Perfectly, perfectly said. Progressive writer and podcaster Jared Yates Sexton wrote an on-point essay this week from his Dispatches from a Collapsing State on what the Mamdani primary victory in New York City told all of us. I mean, here's Zohran Mamdani, who's running on the so-called kitchen table issues, issues that centrist Democrats ever since the election have been urging all Democrats to do, and yet the establishment Democrats were so nervous about their prized positions that they chose to line up behind a failed and disgraced former governor, Andrew Cuomo, because that Mamdani guy talked about something radical, you know, like affordability and free public transit. Revolutionary, I know. And this is what Jared Yates Sexton had to say about those establishment and corporate Dems who viewed Mamdani as more of a threat than the rise of MAGA Republican fascism. Jared Yates Sexton wrote in his post called "Don't Forget Who They Are, Political Amnesia in Times of Crisis," and he writes, "So what does this tell us? Simply that in a time of rising authoritarianism, what matters most is not the relentless assault on our rights, protections, and liberties, but that no one, no matter what, is allowed to gain power if they are so much to the left of Rokana. A simple victory, just one isolated victory, means the difference between continuing the same failed political project and having to deal with the possibility that some things might have to change. This is the secret of politics. All of the fighting, all of the brawling, and all of the pleasant-sounding rhetoric and strongly worded letters hides the fact that there is a political class dedicated to the wealth class, and that is driving the impulse behind all of this." Now, Jared describes how the Democratic Party leadership did everything in its power to tear down the squad, since they not only won on a progressive populist agenda, but because they were not party insiders. The squad represented real working class fighters against the failed neoliberal agenda that's dominated the Democratic Party politics for too long, but helped give us MAGA and Trump. I mean, that's what happened. It delivered MAGA and Trump. But even worse, Jared Yates Sexton explains how those who levy heavier criticisms and attacks against working class progressives, well, they tell on themselves. He says, "Every day, especially in circumstances like this mayoral election, we are given glimpses into the true nature of power. Giving a creep like Andrew Cuomo your support, whether you're a politician, a pundit, or a personality, tells us exactly who you are, as does clicking your heels and getting in line with Trump because of an illegal war your diseased war hawk heart has always desired. Here, the truth is revealed. These people are not your allies. Their principles were never real. And for all of the continued insistence, they do not value the things they purport to." Hear, hear. No. The establishment does not value the things they purport to. Look, I understand this is a New York City mayor race, and it doesn't work in some other places, but it does illustrate how populism works, economic populism works, how, I guess even more, how progressive economic populism works. It works with voters. It resonates with voters. Those running to become the next mayor of Detroit, let me just tell you, I hope that you took notes in what happened in New York City. And part of the progressive economic populist playbook is standing up for the working class in terms of economic and environmental justice, which are intertwined. The Trump regime is forcing to keep a coal-fired power plant operating in West Michigan and is using the federal government to control what a company can or can't do and what a state can or can't do. Wait a second. I'm told that's small government? Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council is my guest, and he'll be up here in a moment. You're listening to LOL.
This isn't a conservative podcast. We actually believe in freedom here, and we don't lose sleep over solar panels either. It's Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. Don't forget, we're on YouTube now. Subscribe to us on YouTube or wherever else you get your podcasts. Tell Pat what you think of the show by contacting him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. Now, let's get back to the show with Pat Johnston.
Check out Left of Lansing on the YouTube. Not only will you get this episode and every other episode, plus the Monday Musings and the Friday Shorts, but you will find my videos and my YouTube Shorts where I provide extra commentary there that you can't get on the podcast. So just look up Left of Lansing and you'll find it on YouTube. Earlier this month, I spoke with legendary West Michigan reporter Sarah Leach, who wrote an extensive story on the Ottawa News Network on the Trump regime's Energy Department's order to stop the scheduled closure of a coal-fired power plant in Ottawa County. Now, the Consumers Energy-owned J.H. Campbell Complex was due to shut down at the end of May as Consumers continued its plans to become carbon neutral. But Energy Secretary and fossil fuel millionaire Chris Wright ordered the plant to remain open due to a sudden quote-unquote energy emergency. Now, not only does this keep fossil fuel pollution harming our environment, but this will mean higher energy costs and higher public health costs for Michiganders. Joining me to talk more about this and how it hurts Michigan environmentally and economically and how best we can fight back against all this is Darrell Slaughter, who is the Natural Resources Defense Council's Michigan Policy Director for Climate and Energy. Darrell, thanks a lot for visiting us once again here on Left of Lansing.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Pat.
Well, as I said in the open there, I had reporter Sarah Leach from the Ottawa News Network give us the story and the politics surrounding the story. But I'm glad you're here because I'd like you to give some more details surrounding not just the politics, but the policy impacts that this move by Trump's Energy Department will mean for Michigan and beyond. So maybe we begin by having you give some background behind Trump's Energy Department's decision to prevent Consumers Energy from closing down the Campbell coal-fired power plant in Olive Township. And perhaps then you can also talk about the process leading to the plant's scheduled closing last month and how the Department of Energy blocked the plant from being closed. Go ahead.
Sure, happy to do so. So to give a background on how we even got to the point of the J. Campbell coal plant being retired, scheduled to be retired, it was actually May 31st, it was scheduled to retire. This retirement date came from the result of a settlement agreement that was struck with groups like NRDC, Sierra Club, a whole host of other groups that were involved in Consumers Energy Long Range Energy Plan. This is a case that investor-owned utilities like Consumers Energy, they have to participate in at the Michigan Public Service Commission, their regulators, where they go through a process of laying out, you know, what is their long-term energy plan for providing energy to all their various ratepayers. And there's a series of processes and reviews in terms of looking at actual finances. There's engineers that do analysis, there's forecasts of what those energy needs are going to be, you know, to make sure that Consumers Energy is setting their future energy needs on the most sustainable path forward. And obviously groups like us want to see that process go in a way that obviously having them prefer to use cleaner sources of energy to meet their future energy needs. One of the main things that we come into the case was to try to get an earlier retirement of the Campbell coal plant. This was actually Consumers Energy's remaining coal plant. We'll say that in 2021, they had Consumers had announced that they were going to retire the coal plant a bit earlier than the previous date. But through the process of us participating in that case and through diligence, through our advocacy, both in the actual case and externally through all the Michiganders that sent thousands of comments to the Public Service Commission, hearing their desire to see this coal plant retired earlier, we were able to strike a great deal with Consumers Energy in 2022 to get this plant closed on the date that it was supposed to be, on May 31st of this year, while also Consumers also committing to expanding the level of renewable energy that they would be using, energy storage, all these cleaner sources to help them provide resources to all their ratepayers. Fast forward to just a few weeks ago, Department of Energy issued an order under the 202C statute, which essentially gives the Department of Energy to intervene in the retirement of such a facility and to claim for energy emergency purposes there, which, you know, there's questions around what does actually constitute energy emergency there, which there's going to be a lot of questions there. And so, you know, from that order, it basically, Consumers was actually in the process of retiring this plant. I mean, they were in their mind, you know, they were, from our understanding, staff, rightfully so, had been beginning the process of transferring them out, not having a ton of coal to actually power the plant because they're anticipating retiring this plant on that retirement date, and a whole host of just other considerations that you would not be having to consider if you're going to retire a plant. And so what this order does is essentially have to, in a quick fashion, force Consumers Energy to get this plant back up in some operational form to comply with the order from the DOE. And this ultimately will result in ratepayers, Consumers Energy ratepayers, having to pay more, or Michiganers by and large having to pay more money for a plant that was, again, slated to be retired. And so there are some really significant financial considerations when we're thinking about this plant staying on longer than was actually anticipated. Again, because Consumers working the plan via the settlement agreement was moving down that path. And so that is where we're at right now. I can share that groups like ours have filed in courts for a rehearing on the order to push back on this emergency order for a lot of the reasons I just stated. This plant was slated to be retired. The claim energy emergency, I think there are real questions around emergency. I think there's been other Michigan officials who have really questioned the idea that we're in an energy emergency. Dan Spritz, the chair of the Public Service Commission, made mention that, you know, Michigan is actually producing more energy than actually taken in from our regional footprint. And so things like that we can point to, along with a whole host of evidence that will be presented, that it shows that it does not look like we're in any type of energy emergency, that the regulators, the entire grid, which is called MISO, is a body of folks that look at the whole entire grid over the whole region. They have stated that they did not feel like there was an emergency, that there's enough generation to make sure that we all have enough energy over the summer to keep electricity going. And so there's going to be a lot of back and forth in terms of what that means in our court case there. And so that's where we're at. And we're working with a whole host of partners to make the case there.
I just want to make sure, though, that I highlight this. And it's something that I've brought up before, but I just want to make sure that we accentuate the point here, is that, as you said, groups such as yours were working with Consumers Energy to close this plant down. You came to an agreement, came to a settlement to do so. Consumers Energy even agreed to move up the date, but it wasn't as if they were closing the plant like they made the announcement, said, all right, the plant's going to be closed in a week. No, they gave a couple of years, you know, notice. Correct. To let everybody prepare for all of this. So again, this was an agreement Consumers Energy went along with, right?
Absolutely. You know, I think probably in some of your listeners and just like the general public, you think environmentalists and utilities are always naturally adversary. We definitely advocated hard in that case, but we came together to come out with a really good agreement that they certainly signed on and agreed to. We obviously did, to retire this coal plant on that date, the 31st of this year. And so, yeah, we were all upset and ready for this plant to be shut down. I know, you know, in their planning, they were as well. And this order came out, and this really throws a wrench in a lot of the plans that were being in place.
This plant, I think, began fully operating on the Lake Michigan shore. What was that, around 1962? If I have that correct, yes. Is that right?
Well before I was even in existence. But yes, 1962. Yeah, a very old plant.
Yeah, I was going to say, well before my existence, too. I was even going to say, I think, I don't even know if I Dream of Jeannie even started yet on TV. Yeah, right. When that came out. But it exactly. does seem, you know, just illogical to keep something like that open, which is old and out of date, not to mention, as you've already mentioned, costly. And that's why you're seeing coal-fired power plants shutting down, not just in Michigan, but across the country. I mean, my dad and I, we visited some family out in western Pennsylvania, and there's a town out there called Home Homer City, and they had this huge coal-fired power plant. It was sort of like part of the scenery, and they knocked it down here recently because they're moving on to other forms of energy. I mean, that is where the future is going, and I think energy companies are realizing that as well, right?
Absolutely. I think you have seen the cost of renewables, solar, wind, and battery storage as well drop significantly. There was a time, you know, last decade and before it, where the argument was, well, these sources aren't cost competitive with coal, you know, or fossil fuels in terms of providing electricity. That is not the case. Renewables are absolutely cost competitive with coal. And I think you are right to your point. I think that's why you have seen utilities on their own start to really look or really invest in renewables there. We can talk about even, you know, Lansing Board of Water Light locally here. You know, we shut down the coal plant and moving towards gas, which that's a whole nother, issue. But I think recognizing that coal is not as cost competitive and recognizing the value of renewables, battery storage, energy efficiency, which is, I think, a really sorely underutilized resource. You know, we could be doing more to make our homes more energy efficient so we're not having to build these huge plants, but it's the way things have been moving for, I think, probably definitely even seeing this movement over the last decade that renewables have become cost competitive of fossil fuels there. And so, yeah, from a lot of people's standpoint, that's really unnecessary.
Now, you and Casey Roberts, who I believe is the director of RTO advocacy for NRDC, both of you, you wrote a blog post on the NRDC site, and it's titled Trump Administration's Department of Energy is Forcing Coal Plants to Stay Open. Michigan is first target, which, of course, we've been talking about here. But you write in that post, and I'm going to quote here, this unprecedented decision will force Midwest customers to pay to operate an aging, inefficient plant, driving up costs at a time when families and businesses are already struggling with high energy prices. Using federal emergency powers where no emergency exists sets a dangerous and expensive national precedent. So, Darrell, this emergency proclamation by the Energy Department, I think if I read this correctly, it was enacted sometime in the 1930s, I guess, to help combat real energy issues like, you know, dealing with natural disasters like hurricanes or something like that. But when you say this is an unprecedented decision, is that to mean that no previous presidency has used it like this to fix an energy problem that didn't exist in the first place? Is that what you're meaning?
To my knowledge, that is the case. Look, especially in terms of when you have, again, a legal settlement that was struck, that was in place to shut down the plant. I'm not aware, you know, maybe there's some case that I'm missing or some instance when the Department of Energy has used this in the past. But to my knowledge, that is not the case. Hence how disruptive it is. And I think you can imagine the shock that all of us felt when we heard the news that this was happening. I haven't talked to too many consumer energy folks, but I would imagine they also had a look of shock that this order came down. And yeah, it's really disruptive and in some ways really disrespectful to the regulatory processes of the hardworking folks at like the Public Service Commission, the MISO organization. The decision that was made was not done haphazardly. I think it took in consideration all of the things that the order is saying in terms of an energy emergency. You know, MISO is absolutely concerned about those sorts of issues, concerns. The Public Service Commission also is absolutely worried about those. And so, yeah, this really just a lack of respect or recognition for like the hard work that goes into ensuring that a plant like this is retiring appropriately and that we have enough energy to make sure folks have electricity.
It seems like the decision to keep this plant open was done haphazardly, if anything. And you brought up Consumers Energy and how this probably caught them off guard. I mean, it will in terms of cost, because now they probably had to scramble and get coal to keep this plant going out there in Ottawa County when they weren't expecting it. I've got to guess that in order to get coal that quickly, that's probably costing them even more.
Yes, it's going to, you know, to get coal on short notice. I haven't like looked at specific prices for that, but I can only imagine that that is not cheap. And who's going to ultimately, because they get to recover their costs, it will ultimately be ratepayers that are going to have to fit the bill for that when it was not a cost that ratepayers should not have to pay out in the first place. And so when you have the cost of getting coal on short notice, you know, there's going to have to be a certain level of staffing to actually run the plant, which is going to cost a certain amount of money. And let's not even talk about any type of unexpected maintenance that's going to need to happen on this plant. Again, as we talked about, this is a very old coal plant, 1962. I'm sure there are maybe things that potentially consumers had not been taking a look at. I don't know that for certain, but like in terms of maintenance, that they just not had not been taken into account because of the fact they were preparing for the retirement. And those costs, which can be incredibly costly, those are going to be costs borne by ratepayers. They're going to have to, you know, pay these costs. And so, again, I keep highlighting how unnecessary this all is. And at the end of the day, the folks who are going to be most hurt by it is the folks who are going to be paying to keep this inefficient old plant running.
Unreal. You know, you also wrote on that blog post that I mentioned that's on the NRDC site about how the Campbell plant produces, you know, this high amounts of pollution that affects not just those communities around the plant, but also it affects many of us then throughout the state and also outside the state. You even had some graphs showing that, some pictures and all that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, and maybe we can put a link or we can direct folks to the blog, but you can see our colleagues with Environmental Law Policy Center, Ecology Center, and Union Concerned Scientists, Bolt Solar. In that case, the case that resulted in settlement, had put in testimony that included analysis of the level of pollution from the Campbell coal plant and what folks would take a look at, which detail the amount of pollution damage by actual dollars and cents that folks would feel as a result of that plant continuing to run. And this comes in the form of hospitalization, asthma, you know, other health effects that come as a result of breathing in the emissions from the burning of coal at Campbell. And so that argument in terms of why the plant shouldn't be running is so apparent because of all the damage it can do to folks' ability to breathe and ultimately affect their health and cost them money and a number of factors there. And so there's just so many reasons for this plant to still be running. And that is absolutely another one, the health impacts.
I've talked about this on the podcast, but Energy Secretary Chris Wright, he is the founder and CEO of Liberty Energy, which made billions in natural gas. And I believe he also said in 2023 that he proclaimed that there is no climate crisis. Did the NRDC and other environmental groups, I know you can't speak for them, but or even those in the clean energy industry, I know you can't speak for everybody, but were these moves anticipated that such moves would happen by Chris Wright once he got into power?
I know my federal colleagues have kept a tab on, and then definitely had colleagues who were aware of Chris Wright and knew his background, his MO. And so I think in some ways we had an inkling that the Trump administration via Secretary Wright would take some really bold steps towards kind of rolling back a lot of the work that groups like mine have at the federal level to ensure that we move our country in a cleaner energy future to actually address climate. But, you know, this, I can only speak to myself. In some way, like this order was somewhat of a surprise, for example. And one of the things that part of our job is to have to continue to remain vigilant and flexible and responsive to this administration's attempts to have trying to roll back all the work, the great regulations and processes that we worked hard to get in place. So I guess in some way, in a generic way, we knew that the Trump administration would be doing things like this, but down to the specifics, at least speaking for me, you know, did not anticipate the interjecting in like the retirement of a coal plant that I think universally folks can look at this plan and say, this is not a good plan to keep running. And, you know, especially for making a case of, you know, we need to keep it running for capacity or for energy emergency reasons. This does not make much sense there. So, and anticipate there'll be more instances like this in the future.
What was your reaction to Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel pushing back against this effort to block the plant's closure? And I think she said she's requesting a hearing with the DOE over, as she called it, its arbitrary and illegal order to stop the plant from shutting down. Is that one of the first steps? I know you said that your group is already taking some actions, but is this something you'd like to see on a state level that you were hoping to see happen?
Absolutely. So happy to see AG Nessel's leadership on this issue. I mean, just kind of watching her tenure as our attorney general has really been really active and engaged on issues at the Public Service Commission, issues related to like affordability. Her team is actively involved in some of the rate cases. These are the cases you know, that raised rates that we all pay. And she has been really good about being a hawk in terms of pushing back all of us in terms of some of these rate increases. And so was not surprised to see her come out as strong to push back on this order. And so she's part of the effort along with us, Earth Justice, Sierra Club, just to name a few organizations, part of this process, Michigan Environmental Council, the pushback on this order, but she's also part of the chorus of groups and entities that push back and request that rehearing there. So, I'll just say, as a Michigander, really proud that she is getting involved in this fight, and because we need her, her and her team, and her lend her voice to this, because it's going to take all of us to really do so, to really be able to push back on this unnecessary order.
Last question, and if you can't answer it, I understand. I know it's a little bit off topic, but is there anything in this huge budget bill that Republicans in D.C. are trying to pass in Congress? Is there anything there that you've been looking at that would harm or possibly, you know, slow down Michigan's efforts to become carbon neutral in the next 15 years since the state did pass that clean energy and jobs bill last year? Have you seen anything there yet?
There are some things, and can't speak to maybe specific pieces, but this globally, I think maybe folks may remember President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act entity. So where there was a series of tax credits that were passed that would help unlock and lower the burden of adopting clean energy. Those tax cuts are potentially on the cutting room floor as part of this budget bill that President Trump and Congress is trying to pass, along with other dollars that would help with energy efficiency, electrification, those sorts of things that are, you know, some of the bread and butter of how we move our country to a cleaner economy. And so just in general, those types of financial incentives are a real threat. And to be frank, those types of incentives help, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. I mean, both folks have taken advantage of those types of incentives. And so, and honestly, there should be bipartisan support of keeping those in place just because of this, how beneficial they are to helping us get more clean energy. And again, clean, efficient energy that's becoming cost competitive into our economy. And so my federal colleagues are definitely tracking those specific pieces like a hawk and trying to do all they can in terms of lobbying legislators, some of our members of Congress here in Michigan and obviously across the country to leave those in place. They are going to really unlock a lot of efficient, clean energy for Michigan and the entire country. I would say in general, yeah, those are probably the areas that we're really focused on and really concerned if rolled back could do a lot of harm there.
Yeah, right. Both economically and environmentally, of course.
Absolutely.
Darrell Slaughter, Natural Resources Defense Council's Michigan Policy Director for Climate and Energy. You can check out his blog post at NRDC called "Trump Administration Department of Energy is Forcing Coal Plants to Stay Open. Michigan is the First Target." I'll make sure to put a link to that wherever you are listening to this podcast and also at leftoflansing.com. Darrell, thank you so much for all of your time and your expertise and for your fight. We greatly appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
He spent nearly 25 years working as a liberal voice in conservative talk radio across the state, and he's still a somewhat stable person. It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. You can find archives of the podcast, plus Pat's musings on other topics in written form at leftoflansing.com. Left of Lansing archives are available wherever you get your podcasts. And now Left of Lansing is available on YouTube. We'd like to thank Audioboom for distributing all our episodes so we can share progressive, otherwise known as common sense, values across Michigan and the country. Now, here's Pat Johnston.
Special thanks to Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council of Michigan for being on this week. Again, I will provide a link to the blog post that he wrote surrounding the regime's big government / corporate authoritarian move to prevent a utility company here in Michigan from shutting down an old coal-fired power plant. You can find that link wherever you are listening to this podcast. Also, I'd like to give a hand to Michigan Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel for trying to fight back against this action, an action that only keeps the fossil fuel industry happy. Look, I have had my criticisms of Attorney General Nessel here of late, and I'm always going to call him as I see him for you. But on this issue and on the issue of always providing a vigorous defense for the people whenever DTE or Consumers Energy proposes massive rate increases, Dana Nessel has always been fighting for the working class, so give credit where cred's due on that front. And one more thing. For all the pearl-clutching going on over Zoran Mamdani's pushing for things like universal health care or rent stabilization in New York City and how that's being deemed as too socialist, we can't have those things here. The same people don't seem to care when the Trump regime used its power to force companies to do things against their will. Time now for the Left of Lansing Last Call. I just wanted to give a couple of thoughts on what did happen in New York City this week as Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani not only posted an upset win over the Democratic establishment in that Democratic Party primary election for mayor, but he won by big numbers. But there have been some disturbing words and images being said and released by many. No, I'm not talking about MAGA fascists and Islamophobes like the Trump regime, Stephen Miller, or nutjob Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, we come to expect that kind of stuff from that side, or from the Gen Z influencer Charlie Kirk, who said something like, 24 years ago, Muslim men committed the 9/11 attacks on New York City, and now today, New Yorkers are backing a Muslim man to lead them. Islamophobia, racism, again, that's what we expect from MAGA Republicanism. What we should not expect, though, is to see the same kind of vitriol from so-called progressives or liberals or Democrats. Now, we know the corporate media will paint Mamdani or somebody like him as some extremist for wanting to provide universal child care, while at the same time telling us the centrist position in politics today in America is how MAGA Republicans in Congress are trying to close down more hospitals across the country, most of them in rural areas. That is supposedly not radical. That is centrism. And we'll be told how MAGA Republicans, led by Dear Leader himself, are trying to say that Mamdani represents a form of America that's really not wanted here, but yet shelling out millions in handouts to the donor class and ripping people from their families as they work at a hardware store, and then you take them to some gulag in a foreign country. We'll be told that is the more centrist position. There's this liberal political analyst, and her name is Rachel Bitkoffer, and she made a bit of a splash last year by being a big Joe Biden supporter, and that's fine. I did some of the same things that she did as well during Biden's tenure, but she's become unhinged since the election, blaming transgender Americans for the rise of MAGA fascism rather than blaming her political establishment buddies for losing the working class vote to Trump. And since Mamdani's victory, she's been on a rampage on social media. And here's one of her posts from the other day, and this is what she said. I know a lot of you are sad about New York City mayor. One, a three-way race may elect the Republican. That will be even sadder. Two, there is nothing I enjoy more than watching idealism crash into reality. Within a year, the far left will hate him. So did you hear that? I mean, there's nothing that Rachel Bitkoffer will enjoy more than watching Mamdani fail at making things more affordable for working-class New Yorkers. What? You see, that's an illness, everyone. And sadly, at least for the time being, it's an illness that is spreading inside the Democratic Party establishment. So I guess that means we might be nearing that stage that I've been calling for ever since the election. It is time for a battle inside the Democratic Party, and it's time for a Tea Party-like fight for the power of the Democratic Party. Look, the people around the country are enraged and afraid of what they're seeing happening on a daily basis. They are demanding leaders to step up, yet some Democratic Party leaders believe, not much needs to change. But to their surprise, especially this week, these Democratic leaders are noticing that people are saying that one thing that needs to change, Democrats.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Special thanks again to Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council for being on the pod this week. Leftoflansing@gmail.com is the best way to reach me. And hey, let me know what you think about the show. I know it's scary times out there. And one of the reasons I started this little venture was to connect with as many of you as possible. Connect with you in ways that I really couldn't in most of my career. Connect with you without being muzzled by corporate talk radio. And being allowed to say things that aren't being said in mainstream media. We've been told a lot of lies over how centrism and neoliberal economics are the best ways forward and that we should always be at war somewhere. Well, we know the truth, and we know that ain't happening. Change is difficult,
But as we saw last year in Delta County up in the UP, where the people stood up against the fascist bullies up there and removed those bullies from their county seats, well, if it can happen there, then change can happen anywhere. It really can. And I'm going to keep pushing for that kind of progressive change and highlighting the good people out there who are fighting to make that progressive change happen on a daily basis. Be safe this weekend. Remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.